You're listening to an Insight 18 special on Money Control.
Sidious, Altius, Fortius. Faster, higher, stronger. That is the motto of the modern Olympics. Pierre de Coubertin proposed that motto, borrowing it from his friend Henri Didon, a Dominican priest. Coubertin said, "These three words represent a program of moral beauty. The aesthetics of sports are intangible. The aesthetics might be intangible, but the economics are very tangible indeed." We've only recently seen the conclusion of the Pyeongchang Winter Olympics, and 2 years ago, the sporting carnival that was the Summer Olympics was held at Rio de Janeiro. The cheer that these games bring is certainly a fact, but are the much-touted economic benefits a myth? Do Olympic host cities and nations experience a tourism growth that is faster, a GDP growth that is higher, and is the state of the overall economy of the host country stronger at the end of the games? That is the question we are asking today. We have spoken to you earlier about the economic benefits and troubles of hosting the Football World Cup, and earlier we've even spoken about the monies of the annual Indian Premier League. In our ongoing series about the business of sport, today we are going to turn our attention to the economics of mankind's greatest celebration of sport, the Olympics. My name is Rakesh, and you're listening to Money Control.
The economics of the Olympic Games.
Few things inspire a country's patriotic spirit like the hosting of a major global sporting event like the World Cup or the Olympics. With the cost of hosting these events well above $1 billion in the modern era, these are essentially mega projects. To prepare for these mammoth events, host countries end up spending billions to modernize infrastructure, build stadiums, increase commerce, and promote tourism. To the casual observer, such activity might seem fertile ground for economic expansion and strong investment performance. But in reality, how well do these mega sporting event mega projects drive growth in a host nation's economy or the equity market? The 23rd edition of the Winter Olympics, dubbed the Peace Olympics, held in Pyeongchang, is still fresh in our memory. So now is as good a time as any to ask the all-important question. Do the Olympics drive economic growth in host countries? And if so, by how much? Historically, the simple answer to that question and the end of the podcast is no, they do not. But the more cryptic answer is, well, a yes and no. And to unpack the economics of the Olympic Games and to read between the pros and cons of the greatest sporting extravaganza of humankind is the primary motive behind this edition of the Deep Dive. First, let's start with the host of the latest edition of the Winter Olympics, South Korea. And perhaps no other country has used the Olympics as a platform for not just political advancement, but also as a display of the nation's power on the global stage better than South Korea. Of course, the Olympics are all about the sport, but there is no running away from the political. So let's first address the relationship of South Korea with the Olympics and how indeed the political is rarely ever disconnected from the spectacle of sport. South Korea's first time as an Olympic host was for the 1988 Summer Games in Seoul, which marked a historic turn that widened the scope of its diplomacy with Eastern Bloc countries, facilitated South Korea's democratic transition, and exhibited to the world the accomplishments of a rapidly developing nation. 3 decades later, the hope was much the same in 2018. South Korea hoped that hosting the 2018 Winter Olympics in the city of Pyeongchang would generate equivalent diplomatic, political, economic and image-enhancing benefits, especially in contrast with their neighbors to the north, North Korea. In 1988, South Korea was the 18th largest economy in the world. For one of the world's newest democracies and an Asian developmental success story, the Seoul Olympics were a coming-out party, signifying South Korea's entry into the developed world. Today, South Korea is an industrialized economy that ranked 11th in the world in 2016. And the Olympics are an affirmation of the country's global leadership, an opportunity for it to push for peace on the Korean peninsula and promote its soft power via movies, pop songs and other cultural contributions, not to mention its strong industry. Echoing its message at the 1988 Seoul Olympics, South Korea once again argued that hosting a peace Olympics would harness the Games' spirit to overcome rising inter-Korean tensions. Although such prospects seemed to diminish in the face of rising US-North Korea nuclear tensions throughout 2017, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un unexpectedly extended an offer in his New Year's address to reduce tensions with South Korea in exchange for an invitation to North Korea to participate in the Olympics. South Korean President Moon Jae-in eagerly accepted Kim Jong-un's offer to resume dialogue, which Moon had been calling for since June. The Moon administration quickly agreed to North Korean athletes entering the Games opening ceremony under the unified Korea flag and to host North Koreans, including musicians, athletes, officials, cheerleaders, and a taekwondo team in Olympics-related festivities. Subsequent negotiations between the IOC, that is the International Olympic Committee, and representatives from the two Koreas paved the way for 22 North Korean athletes to join skiing and skating events, as well as for a united Korean team in the Olympics. Players from the North and South competed together in women's hockey. The role of the Olympics in easing North-South Korea tensions can hardly be overstated. Kim Jong-un and Moon Jae-in did have talks a few months after the conclusion of the Games. We all saw pictures of them meeting at the DMZ and stepping into each other's territories. The Games may not have cured all or, well, any of the problems between the two countries, but they certainly made room for some conversation between them. And why am I talking about political tensions when we're talking about the economics of the Games? Because, well, attached to the latest venue of the Olympics was also the possibility of escalation of tensions between these two countries, and that affects the geopolitical climate globally, as well as, of course, global markets. Let's not forget that North Korea is nuclear capable, isolated, and under the leadership of a man who fashions himself as being slightly disruptive. So the political aspects of the Olympic Games did take just as much importance as the sporting itself. But returning to the economic benefits that Korea reaped in the Olympics, a common thread for both Korean Olympic Games is the South Korean government's emphasis on infrastructure development. And that is what we're going to concentrate on now on this deep dive. The Olympic Village in Seoul, a part of the city's southward expansion back in 1988, was accompanied by significant upgrades to public transportation and infrastructure, including new athletic facilities and public parks. Likewise, the Pyeongchang Olympics created an opportunity to build out national transportation and sports infrastructure in the Gangwon province in northeast South Korea, with high-speed rail links and new winter sporting facilities that Koreans now hope will attract visitors from across Asia. Let's also remember that South Korea relies less than most countries on tourism. Tourism only makes up 1.8% of its GDP. Let's turn back to 1988 and see how South Korea benefited from the spotlight that it was under. In 1988, the Seoul Games put South Korea on the map for many global viewers and provided an extended brand awareness of South Korean conglomerates to new global markets. The Seoul Olympics coincided with companies such as Hyundai, Samsung, and Lucky Gold Star, that is LG, pushing their automobiles, electronics, and household goods into new markets on every continent. In the new millennium, South Korea's advanced technology and cultural products, cutting-edge cell phones and apps, television dramas, movies, and pop culture icons are the things that officials have hoped will benefit most from South Korea's return to the spotlight. The South Korean hope before taking on the Olympic mantle once again was that the marketing of Korean culture overtakes reporting on security risks. If the 1988 Seoul Olympics were a coming-out party for the country, South Korea's hope this time around were for it to be perceived as a mature and modern leader, able to host the world with confidence and good grace. The Olympics provided a unique but possibly fleeting instrument to try to bridge the gap between North and South Korea. The irony, of course, was that no matter its pride and capacity, South Korea's success ultimately depended on cooperation by the North, and to that extent, the Peace Olympics achieved what it had set out to do. The Pyeongchang Winter Olympics were a largely peaceful, cooperative affair. Were the economic aims and objectives laid down for the Olympics achieved? For Pyeongchang, it's still too early to tell. But stick around, we'll tell you all about Rio, the first South American venue of the Olympic Games. But first, what are the costs of hosting the Olympics? One of the great problems when it comes to understanding the costing of the Olympics is just how there are no concrete ways to measure the overruns, or indeed to measure the actual cost of the Olympics. Considering there are quite as many zeros within the logo of the Olympics, perhaps it stands to reason that the hosting of the Olympics also involves a lot of zeros. The Olympics have, of course, evolved dramatically since the first modern games were held in 1896, both in terms of scale and cost. In the second half of the 20th century, both the costs of hosting and the revenues produced by the spectacle grew rapidly, sparking controversy over the burdens host countries shouldered. A growing number of economists argued that both the short and long-term benefits of hosting the Olympics are at best exaggerated and at worst non-existent, leaving many host countries with large debts and maintenance liabilities. Instead, many argue that Olympic committees should reform the bidding and selection process to incentivize realistic budget planning, increase transparency, and promote sustainable investments that serve the public interest. But more on that later. Rio's 2016 Games highlighted the ongoing debate over the costs and benefits of hosting such a mega event. Close to 2 years later, the city is still struggling with debt incurred, maintenance costs for abandoned facilities, under-equipped public services, and rising crime, even as candidate cities for future games withdraw their bids or scale down their plans. This is unfortunately not a new story. Interest in the cost of the games has been high since the establishment of the modern Olympics in 1896. As long ago as 1911, Baron Pierre de Coubertin, the man responsible for establishing the modern games, referred to the often exaggerated expenses incurred for the most recent Olympiads. Jean Drapeau, the mayor of Montreal in the 70s, famously stated once, and I quote, "The Montreal Olympics can no more have a deficit than a man can have a baby," unquote. Famous last words because the Montreal Olympics are famous for having run over the estimated cost by well over 9.5 times. Despite substantial interest in the costs of the games, however, attempts to specifically and systematically evaluate the costs and cost overruns of the games are very few, and even while those that do attempt them are often focused on a specific edition of the games. Previous research on the costs of the Olympics has instead focused on whether the games present a financially viable investment from a cost-benefit analysis perspective. But what to measure when determining the costs and benefits of the games to a host country are often up for debate. In particular, legacy benefits described in the bid are often intangible and as such pose a difficulty in ex-post evaluations. The benefits to increased tourism revenue, jobs created by Olympic needs, or national pride are hugely varied and quite difficult to quantify. Now, I cannot possibly quantify the pride the South Koreans might have felt at having hosted a successful Olympic Games because there isn't a number that tells me that. Costs are equally hard to determine. For example, one could argue that if hotels in the city have invested in renovations in view of the Olympics and benefits of increased tourist revenues to those hotels are included in the benefit analysis, then those costs should also be included in any accounting, but they're not. Similarly, the percentage of work that an employee in an outlying city spends on games-related work would be exceptionally difficult to estimate. So there are already troubles in trying to understand what the costs of the Olympics in general are. What we must also bear in mind are a couple of things. I already described how the modern Olympics are mega projects, meaning they involve expenditure of more than $1 billion. But what has stood out about the Olympics in comparison to any other mega projects are two things. One, the games overrun with 100% consistency. No other type of mega project is this consistent regarding cost overrun. Other types of projects are typically on budget from time to time, but never the Olympics. Every single modern Olympics has overshot its budget. And number two, with an average cost overrun in real terms of 179% and 324% in nominal terms, overruns in the games have historically been significantly larger than for other types of mega projects, including infrastructure, construction, ICT, dam projects. The data, therefore, show that for a city and nation to decide to host the Olympic Games is essentially to take on one of the most financially risky types of mega projects that exist, something that many cities and nations have learned to their peril. All of these very real issues have led to many economists asking for a complete revision of the bidding process itself. The competition for hosting the Olympic Games has become a hotly debated political arena in which cities pitch their ideas for urban development against each other to win the opportunity to host the world's biggest sporting event. Cities prepare something called the bid book, or formally called the candidature files. In these books, cities detail their abilities and plans to pull off the world's biggest sporting event, that is the Olympics. And one of the major requirements to be inserted into this book is budgets that form the basis of the expected investment by the host country and city's governments, in addition to funds generated as revenue. In the bid book, the governments of candidate countries are also required by the International Olympic Committee to provide guarantees to ensure the financing of all major capital infrastructure investments required to deliver the Olympic Games and cover a potential economic shortfall of the OCOG, which is the Organizing Committee of the Olympic Games. The bid book is a legally binding agreement and as such represents the baseline from which future costs and cost overruns should be measured. But, and it's a big but, this is rarely ever done. New budgets are developed after the bid has been awarded to the city, and these new budgets are often substantially different and look nothing like those presented at the bidding stages. These new budgets are often used as new baselines, rendering measurement of cost overrun inconsistent and factually misleading. New budgets continue to evolve and develop over the course of planning for the Games until the final actual costs are presented, often several years after the Games' completion, if at all they're presented. Here, it's good to remember what happened at the Sochi Winter Olympics. It was originally budgeted at $12 billion, but eventually ended up costing $51 billion, more than three times the cost of the Summer Olympics in London. The costs surpassed even the 2008 Summer Olympics at Beijing, one of the most expensive Summer Olympics. Also, remember that the Summer Olympics are a more expensive event than the Winter Olympics. They have more athletes, they have more events, and the Sochi Winter Olympics, a third the size in terms of scale, ended up costing much more than the most expensive Summer Olympics. Since when did this become a problem? When did costing become such a problem in the Olympics? That's what we'll find out next. So when did the Olympics become so expensive to host? When did it get these airs and graces? For much of the 20th century, the staging of the Olympic Games was a manageable burden for the host cities. The events were held in developed countries, either in Europe or the United States, and in the era before television broadcasting, hosts did not expect to make a profit. Instead, the Games were publicly funded, with these advanced countries better positioned to bear the costs due to their larger economies and, more often than not, already in place infrastructure. The 1970s marked a turning point. Here, we have to acknowledge the work of Andrew Zimbalist, who is a professor of economics at Smith University and the author of the book Circus Maximus, The Economic Gamble Behind Hosting the Olympics and the World Cup, a book I read with great interest in preparation for this podcast. In the 1970s, the Games were growing rapidly, with the number of Summer Olympics participants almost doubling and the number of events increasing by a third during the 60s. Every Olympics since 1960 has seen major cost overruns. The killing of protesters in the days before the 1968 Mexico City Games and the fatal assault on Israeli athletes at the 1972 Munich Games tarnished the image of hosting the Olympics, and public skepticism of taking on debt to host the Games grew. In 1972, Denver became the first and only chosen host city to reject its Olympics after voters passed a referendum refusing additional public spending for the Games, and Denver has remained an exception. The 1976 Summer Olympics in Montreal came to symbolize the fiscal risk of hosting the Games. The projected cost of $124 million was billions below the actual cost, largely due to construction delays and cost overruns for a new stadium, saddling the city's taxpayers with some $1.5 billion in debt that took nearly three decades to pay off. 2006 is when they paid it off. As a result, right after that, in 1979, Los Angeles was the only city to bid for the 1984 Summer Olympics, allowing it to negotiate exceptionally favorable terms with the International Olympic Committee, that is the IOC. Most importantly, LA was able to rely almost entirely on existing stadiums and other infrastructure rather than promise new facilities to entice the IOC selection committee. Of course, it was not like the IOC had much of a choice, considering LA was the only city that bid. What also happened during this time was important. A sharp jump in television broadcast revenue, which made LA the only city to turn in a profit hosting the Olympics. Los Angeles ended with a surplus of about $215 to $220 million. For comparison, let's take a look at broadcast revenue from Olympics television rights fees between 1980, that is the Moscow Olympics, where it was just $88 million, and Los Angeles, where the fees jumped to $286.9 million. The London broadcast revenue from the Olympics television rights fees was as much as $2,600 million. But the jump happened with Los Angeles, and that may have chummed the waters. LA's success led to a rising number of cities bidding. There were two for the 1988 Games, and there were 12 for the 2004 Games. This allowed the International Olympic Committee to choose the cities with the most ambitious and often the most expensive plans. In addition, bidding by developing countries more than tripled after 1988. Countries such as China, Russia, and Brazil have been eager to use the Games to demonstrate their progress on the world stage. Let's also remember that the Olympics are not simply about sport, they're also about the host country presenting itself as having arrived on the world stage. We've seen that in the Korea story. But these host cities, not as advanced as those in Europe or in the United States, invested massive sums to create the necessary infrastructure. Costs spiraled to over $45 billion for the 2008 Beijing Games. The Winter Games in Sochi in 2014, $51 billion. It was a check for $20 billion for the Rio Games in 2016. And the latest Pyeongchang Games gave a bill of $13 billion, almost twice as much as the planned $7 billion. The LA story was a good story. It made money. But that story was based on not having to build stuff anew. But in the stories that have followed since, things had to be built from the ground up, resulting in cost overruns. These severe cost overruns have again led to renewed skepticism, and a number of cities have already withdrawn their bids for the 2022, 24, and 28 Games over these cost concerns. Oslo and Stockholm both backed out of their 2022 bids upon realizing that costs would be higher than originally estimated. Boston withdrew from consideration for the 2024 Games, with its mayor saying that he refused to mortgage the future of the city away. The 2024 finalists, Budapest, Hamburg, and Rome, also withdrew, leaving only Los Angeles and Paris in the fray. In an unprecedented move, given the lack of candidates, the IOC chose the 2024 and 2028 venues simultaneously in 2017, with Paris hosting in 2024 and Los Angeles in 2028. Some of the cities that backed out eventually quite possibly did so after looking at a few graphs. Just to give you an estimate about how GDP was affected after the hosting of the Olympics, take a look at South Korea in 1988. GDP growth two quarters before the Olympics was hovering near 16%, and GDP growth two quarters after the Olympics was nearly at 4%. I understand all the commercial activity that existed in the lead up to the Games are no longer there, but still, two quarters after the Olympics got over, the GDP growth was at 4%. That is a difference of 12% in GDP growth, all because of the hosting of the Olympics. Doesn't really pay off. Some more examples, if you don't believe me. The Barcelona Olympics in 1992 left the central Spanish government $4 billion in debt, and the city and provincial governments an additional $2.1 billion in debt. The Nagano Winter Olympics in 1998 is a whole other story because we will never know the whole story. The full cost of the Nagano Olympics will never be known because the documents accounting for money spent on the Olympic bid were burnt on the orders of the Nagano Olympic Committee's Vice Secretary General. Yet, it is clear that it went vastly over budget and pushed Nagano into recession. Athens is probably the biggest cautionary tale. The Athens Olympics of 2004 vastly exceeded its $4.6 billion budget. Many believe the real accrued debt of roughly $15 billion contributed greatly to Greece's financial crisis, something it has still not emerged out of in 2018. So, okay, I've been telling you that cities have to spend a lot of money. What do they spend it on? From the beginning of expressing interest in hosting the Olympics till the end of the Games, what are the different costs? Cities must first invest millions of dollars in evaluating, preparing, and submitting a bid to the IOC. The cost of planning, hiring consultants, organizing events, and the necessary travel consistently falls between $50 and $100 million, and this is even before the bid has been approved. Tokyo, for example, spent as much as $150 million on its failed 2016 bid and about half that much for its successful 2020 bid. So essentially, for these two bids put together, it was $225 million spent by Tokyo. and it is not even the beginning of the actual Olympic expenses. Toronto, on the other hand, decided it couldn't even afford the $60 million it would have needed for a 2020 bid and backed out. Now, once a city is chosen to host, it has nearly a decade to prepare for the influx of athletes and tourists. The Summer Games are obviously far larger, attracting hundreds of thousands of foreign tourists to watch over 10,000 athletes compete in over 300 events, compared to about 3,000 athletes competing in about 100 events at the Winter Games. This is why Sochi is an example of exceptional cost mismanagement. For a Games a third the size of the Summer Games, Sochi ended up being the most expensive installment in Olympic history, summer and winter included. The most immediate need after the city is chosen is the creation or upgrading of highly specialized sports facilities like cycling tracks, ski jumping arenas, the Olympic Village, and a venue large enough to host the opening and closing ceremonies. There is also usually the need for far more general infrastructure, especially housing and transportation. The IOC requires the city hosting the Summer Games to have a minimum of 40,000 available hotel rooms, which in Rio's case necessitated the construction of 15,000 new hotel rooms. Roads, train lines and airports need to be upgraded or constructed. For example, in Rio, $3 billion was spent for a rail line connecting the city to the venue of the Olympics, now largely unused and not serving a larger purpose. Altogether, these infrastructure costs range from $5 billion to over $50 billion. Many countries justify such expenditures in the hopes that the spending will outlive the Olympic Games. For example, some 85% of the Sochi 2014 Games' more than $50 billion budget went into building non-sports infrastructure from scratch. Let's also remember that they had to import snow for the Winter Games. Anyway, more than half of Beijing 2008's budget of $45 billion went to rail, roads and airports, while nearly a fourth went into environmental cleanup efforts. $450 million, for example, was spent in building the Bird's Nest, the stadium that hosted the opening and closing ceremonies. It costs Beijing $11 million annually still for its upkeep and is not always utilized. In another case, the stadium that was built in Sydney for the Sydney Olympics is now going to be broken down and constructed again. And we've all seen photographs of many venues built for Beijing Olympics and the Rio Olympics, which have now gone into disrepair and are essentially sites for vandalism, as they sit unused or underutilized. Pyeongchang in South Korea built a brand new Olympic stadium to host the Winter Games this year. The 35,000-seat stadium cost $109 million to build, and it would have been used just four times before it's demolished. You actually heard me right, it's going to be demolished. The cost of the stadium will come to an astonishing $10 million per hour of use, according to Judith Grant Long, who is a scholar of sports at the University of Michigan. Now, the reason Pyeongchang plans to destroy the arena is pretty straightforward. The county it is situated in has about 40,000 people. In order to fill the stadium after the Olympics and the Paralympics are over, almost every single person living in the area would have to attend an event there simultaneously to fill it up. The stadium is useless for locals. Now, returning to what the cities spend on. Operational costs. They make up a smaller but significant chunk of the host's Olympics budget. Security costs have escalated quickly. Reason? 9/11. Sydney, for example, spent $215 million on security in 2000. And cut to 2004, Athens spent $1.5 billion. And costs these days have remained between $1 and $5 billion, depending on the expert you read. Also problematic are the so-called white elephants, or expensive facilities that, because of their size or specialized nature, have limited post-Olympics use. The stadium in Sydney, the stadium in Pyeongchang, almost all of the facilities built for the 2004 Athens Olympics, whose costs contributed to the Greek debt crisis, sit unused. The Gangwon province in South Korea, where Pyeongchang is, expects to spend about $8.5 million annually for the upkeep of the unused venues built for the Games. Economists say the Games' so-called implicit costs must also be considered. Now, what are these implicit costs? These include the opportunity costs of public spending that could have been spent on other priorities. Servicing the debt that is left over after hosting the Games can burden public budgets for decades. Take a look at Montreal, for example. It had to pay off its debt until 2006, and Greece's billions in Olympics debt has helped bankrupt the country. A bankruptcy, let me repeat, it has still not emerged from. The debt and maintenance costs of the Sochi 2014 Games will cost Russian taxpayers nearly $1 billion every year for the foreseeable future, experts have gone on to say. And there are worries that the solvency of some major Russian banks is threatened by the billions of dollars in bad Olympics-related loans. So these are some of the costs that the cities incur from the time of deciding to host till the time the Olympics are over. And it's a lot of costs. While some in Sochi, for example, see the unused and other overbuilt facilities as a waste, other residents argue that the games spurred spending on roads, water systems, and other public goods that wouldn't have otherwise happened. So like I said earlier, we have to weigh the pros and cons. Do the cons appear bigger? Almost certainly. But are there pros? That is a definite yes as well. So let's consider some of them. The 1984 Games in Los Angeles were the only ones to produce a surplus. We know this. And this was in large part because the city was able to rely on already existing infrastructure and they didn't have to build new stadiums or any of those white elephants that we discussed. As the costs of hosting have skyrocketed, revenues cover only a fraction of expenditures. Beijing's 2008 Summer Olympics generated $3.6 billion in revenue, and that's a huge number. But compare that with the cost of over $40 billion, and you know the difference. London's 2012 Games generated $5.2 billion in revenue, but the costs were $18 billion. Not exactly a fair bargain. What's more, much of the revenue does not go to the host. The IOC keeps more than half of all television revenue, typically the single largest chunk of money generated by the games. Take for example 2009 to 2012. $8.05 billion were generated in revenue, and of that, $3,850 million came from television revenues, and more than half of that was kept by the IOC. Impact studies carried out or commissioned by host governments before the games often argue that hosting the event will provide a major economic lift by creating jobs, drawing tourists, and boosting overall economic output. But research carried out after the games shows that these purported benefits are dubious. It's time to bust a couple of myths. Myth number one, job creation. In the 2002 Salt Lake City Winter Games, a study found a short-term boost of 7,000 additional jobs. But was it as much as the number that was promised? Well, no. 70,000 jobs were promised by officials, and here we did not also see any long-term increase in employment. As a study by the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development explained, the jobs created by Olympics construction are often temporary, and unless the host region is suffering from high unemployment, the jobs mostly go to workers who are already employed, blunting the impact on the broader economy. Another example, only 10% of the 48,000 jobs that were created during the London Olympics went to previously unemployed people. And that's just 4,800 jobs out of the 48,000 that were created during the 2012 Olympics. So do Olympics create jobs? Well, they might for a little bit, but does it sustain for long? Nope. Myth number two, boost to tourism. Another explanation that hosting countries offer is that tourism will get a major boost. This is mostly a myth. Economists have found that the impact on tourism is mixed, as the security, crowding, and higher prices that the Olympics bring dissuade many visitors. Barcelona, for example, which hosted in 1992, is cited as a tourism success story, and it is true. It rose from the 11th to the 6th most popular destination in Europe after the Summer Games there. And it is also true of places like Sydney and Vancouver, which both saw slight increases in tourism after they hosted. But in many other cities, that has not been the case. London, Beijing, and Salt Lake City all saw decreases in tourism during the years of their Olympics. As somebody who was in England during the Olympics, I can vouch for the fact that many people avoided going to London altogether, citing the overcrowding in the city by tourists. Sure, Londoners certainly enjoyed the Olympics, but did they also crib non-stop about the overcrowding and the traffic? Most certainly, Governor. Ultimately, there is little evidence of overall positive economic impact. Boston's National Bureau of Economic Research has published findings that hosting has a positive impact on a country's international trade, but some other economists found no long-term impact of hosting on a country's GDP. And in fact, as we saw earlier, there has been a decrease in the GDP growth rate once the hosting has taken place. So we've only spoken about the cons and myths. Are there pros? Yes, there are. National pride and the joy of being able to show off one's culture to the rest of the world and the temporary rise in commercial activities, especially if you're a business person or a shopholder. All of these can be momentarily thought of as pros. But do these pros outweigh the cons? Absolutely not. yes, the country gets visibility. Yes, the hosting city gets visibility. Yes, the culture of the hosting country gets exported to places where they may have hitherto not had an opportunity to go to. And agreed, one cannot quantify these intangible aspects in pure economic terms. But even a cursory look at the tangible aspects of the games make it an unwieldy economic exercise. Let's take the case of the most recent Summer Olympics, that is the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Games. What was the outcome of these games? The final tally for Brazil, the first South American country to host the Olympics, exceeded $20 billion, with the city of Rio alone shouldering at least $13 billion of the bill. The country also faced a number of additional challenges stemming from its precarious economic and political situation. The scramble to finish preparations came amid political chaos after President Dilma Rousseff was removed from office in 2016, while the country was facing its worst recession in decades. The state required a $900 million bailout from the federal government to cover the policing costs of the Olympics and is still unable to pay all of its public employees, which some analysts say has contributed to the city's rising violent crime. The city also had to invest heavily in a broad range of infrastructure, much of it with dubious long-term utility. The city built four clusters of stadiums and other facilities connected by new highways and rail lines. Most of these came in far over budget, with a state auditor finding the city's $3 billion subway extension was overbilled by at least 25%. The construction was meant to reinvigorate some of Rio's struggling neighborhoods, and yet, more than a year later, most venues are either abandoned or barely used. The Olympic Park is closed, with most of its facilities overrun with waste and infested with insects and rodents, along with many instances of vandalism. The nearly 4,000 apartments that made up the athletes' village were meant to be converted into housing for citizens, but sit vacant. In this regard, I can think of one example where India has sort of done well. The National Games Village, which was built for the National Games in Bangalore, is now a fully occupied residential area in Koramangala in Bangalore. But returning to Rio, government attempts to auction the venues to private owners have failed, leaving the city with a $14 million annual price tag for maintenance. Meanwhile, at least 77,000 people were evicted from their homes in the course of construction, and the city, still dealing with its budget crisis, has since suspended its promised program to clean Rio's deeply polluted waterways. So is the city better off after hosting the Olympics? Well, if you think barely used rail lines, increasing crime and increasing unemployment and the sacrificing of other more important projects that could have been funded instead of the Olympics is a good thing, then yeah, sure, the city is in a better state. But if you don't, like most sane human beings, then no, Rio is certainly not in a better state. How can the games be made more manageable? That's what we'll find out on the last part of this podcast.
The economics of the Olympic Games.
How can the Olympics be made more manageable? Let's finally talk about solutions. Consensus has grown among economists that the Olympic Games need reform for them to be made more affordable and more economically viable. Many have pointed out that the IOC bidding process encourages wasteful spending by favoring potential hosts who present the most ambitious plans for the Games. And these plans, more often than not, will neither go to fruition nor do they get made within the given budget. We have found out that they always overrun and more often than not lead the country and the city to great economic crisis. This so-called winner's curse means that overinflated bids, often pushed by construction and hospitality interests, consistently overshoot the actual value of the hosting. Andrew Zimbalist, in his book, goes on to say that the bidding process is at the behest of construction and hospitality interests rather than the local governments, which is not a hard guess to make, considering they stand to gain most during the Olympics preparation stages. The other big problem is corruption. Corruption has consistently dogged the IOC selection process. Bribery scandals marred the 1998 Nagano Olympics and the 2002 Salt Lake City Games. As we found out earlier, Nagano's bid papers were ordered to be burnt by the organizing committee's vice secretary general. As recently as 2017, that's last year, the head of Rio's organizing committee was charged with corruption for allegedly making payments to secure the Brazil Games. Allegations of illegal payments have surfaced in the 2020 Tokyo selection as well. As we already know, $225 million have been spent by Tokyo in their 2016 and 2020 bids, and the final securing of the 2020 bid was not without raising doubts of dubious circumstances. Every vested interest clearly wants a piece of the rich, succulent, cash-giving Olympic pie. In response to these corruption allegations, the IOC president Thomas Bach has promoted reforms to the process known as the Olympic Agenda 2020. These recommendations include reducing the cost of bidding, allowing hosts more flexibility in using already existing sports facilities, encouraging bidders to develop a sustainability strategy, and increasing outside auditing and other transparency measures. Are these enough? Well, no. Some people do think more drastic measures are necessary. Economists Bauman and Matheson argue that developing countries should be spared the burden of hosting altogether, and the IOC should instead award the games to rich countries that are better able to absorb more of the costs. Andrew Zimblist, whose book I wholeheartedly recommend, goes on to say that one city should be made the permanent host, allowing reuse of expensive infrastructure. Barring that, he argues that any city planning to host should ensure that the games fit into a broader strategy to promote development that will outlive the Olympic festivities. In fact, the single permanent host idea was also favored by Christine Lagarde, head of the International Monetary Fund, who said she would prefer having Athens as the permanent host of the Summer Olympics. The logic is mostly sound. Why not build the required 35 sports venues, the Olympic Village, and the Broadcasting and Media Center only once instead of building them afresh, anew, every 5 years in a different city? Yes, the logic is mostly sound. There are three problems with this symbolically soothing suggestion. Number one, what is Athens going to do with the venues for the other 3 years and 348 days? Number two, aren't there better uses for thousands of acres of scarce real estate? And number three, where is Athens to find the $2 billion that it would require every 4 years for Olympics security purposes? Let's not forget that Athens is in Greece, and Greece is in a debt crisis. Zimbalist goes on to say there's a better idea. Why not make Los Angeles the permanent host? It has all the venues, the needed infrastructure, and the hotels. He claims there is no US or LA chauvinism in his modest plan. He does not believe that LA would benefit, but he also believes it wouldn't lose. The losers would be the US taxpayers who would have to foot the $2 billion security bill every 4 years. And can they afford it? Well, I have a feeling they can. Research has comprehensively shown that a fourth comparative adjective needs to be added to the Citius Altius Fortius. Perhaps populous, poorer. While the Olympics bring riches beyond one's imagination, physical feats that are too unhuman to comprehend, an otherworldly resilience in Olympians, and a truly humanizing celebration of the human spirit, but it is without question also a process that needs more harnessing and streamlining. It is a wild horse at this stage which needs to be braided down and made dressage worthy. Disciplined, within the line, and cooperating with the jockey. That is the host nation. Thank you for joining us. This has been a deep dive into the economics of hosting the Olympic Games. And on behalf of everyone here at the Money Control Podcast Desk, this is me, Rakesh, saying thank you again. And stay logged on to moneycontrol.com to be a smart listener and an even smarter investor.
This is an Insight 18 special on Money Control.